We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
ILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Professor Walter McMahon. Walt McMahon has been at the University of Illinois for how many years, Walt?
Since 1957.
And you've recently written a very important book that's gotten wonderful reviews called Higher Learning, Greater Good, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Why did you write this book? What was the problem that caused you to pull all this information together?
Well, I thought not enough attention was being given to the outcomes of higher education. So much attention is given in the legislature, for instance, to costs, but they don't pay all that much attention to the private and the social benefits to the state.
We've sort of advertised this program as we're talking about what has your education done for you and the community in which you live. And your book analyzes very well those benefits to people who've had the advantage of higher education. One of the problems you talk about in your book is the fact that in the United States, we have only, let's see if I can remember the number, is it 39% of people between the ages of 25 and 35 who have gone to college, whereas in, say, South Korea or Japan or other countries like that, it's higher, 50% or something.
Well, that's very true. We're falling far behind South Korea, falling behind Canada. Many other countries now have a larger percentage going on. There's a backlog out there of people who have finished higher education in the U.S., so our overall education level is a little bit higher, but these other countries are catching up to us very rapidly.
And when you measure that age group between 25 and 35, some of them have surpassed us, as you say.
Yes, that's right.
And in a world society where there's the kind of globalization that you point out very well in this book, and we're becoming more and more technical. You and I were sharing our iPhones earlier. to survive, you have to kind of learn the new technology. It's really a great disadvantage if you don't have the kind of education that enables you to keep learning throughout your life.
Yes, this is a really very serious problem, and many of the lower skilled jobs are shifting overseas to China, to India. When you rent a car nowadays, you're as likely to be talking to somebody in Mumbai as you are here in the U.S. And you know, as a result of this and that in part, but also the onrush of technology, there's a huge skill deficit in the United States. Only about 64% of the people have a high school education or less, whereas less than a majority have a two-year, and I do talk about associate degree programs as well as four-year bachelor's programs and graduate programs. So a majority of the people have less than college.
Now, what do you mean when you say a skill deficit in this country?
Well, it shows up in a number of ways. If you look at what occupations are growing the fastest and where are the jobs, the fastest growing occupations, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the 30 fastest, all, except for about two, require an associate degree or a bachelor's degree.
At least two years in college or four.
Right. So that's where the jobs are. That's where the job growth is. the two that are not growing tend to be home health care aides, things related to an aging population.
Uh-huh.
And so people doing this can have short on-the-job training and do not need more advanced skills. But there's even a call there for people being born professional and home health care aides having somewhat more training, practical nurse training, for example.
Sure.
So even in those areas, you find it. Or
Now, your recent book, Higher Learning, Greater Good, has received a number of awards. Let's see if I can find where that's described. I was very, very impressed to learn that it was the winner of the best book in education from the Professional Scholarly Publishing Division of the Association of American Publishers. So out of all the books published since this came out, this was given the Best Book Award. Your background, of course, as a professor of education here at the University of Illinois helped prepare you for this, but you also have a chair. You've been a professor in economics as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true. I mean, my field really is primarily economics, and my degree is in that area. But the economics of education spans these two disciplines, so I have a joint appointment in education and in economics.
And your focus throughout your career has been on looking at the economic effects of education.
Well, yes, although I've taught for many years and written a number of articles in macroeconomic analysis, which has to do with unemployment, inflation, economic growth, and okay. Got interested in the sources of productivity growth. And, of course, education contributes very significantly to productivity growth. So there's a connection there between the economy and the skills in the labor force and education, what education contributes.
And I'm sure that one of the reasons that this book has had such a strong impact across the country and even more broadly around the world in the field of education is because for the first time, it looks like, you've really been able to measure the benefits of education to individuals and to the community, to society.
Yes, I've really attempted to do that. It's probably the most comprehensive effort to do that. There are hundreds, probably even thousands, of articles in the economics journals that do measure, using regression methods mostly, the effects, net effects of education after you control for all kinds of other things, including ability, what the net effects are. But bringing these together and trying to get an estimate of what the total, sum of individual types of benefits, but also the sum of the total private benefits to individual persons as well as to the state of Illinois and to our country. So it has moved in that direction, really, I think, for the first time, probably.
I noticed that the former president of the American Council of Education, Stanley Eikenberry, who is also, of course, a former president here at the University of Illinois, has said about your book, Higher Learning, Greater Good is a detailed and thoughtful contribution to education and policy debates that deserves a careful reading by all who care about the future. When Stan Eikenberry says something like that about a book, given his reputation, it means people should take it seriously. I was thinking as I read it that, presidents of universities and chancellors and state legislators should certainly read this because, as you mentioned earlier, there's so much concern about the costs of higher education and very little talk about all of the benefits to people. There's been a lot of money spent for science, for technology, Of course, the federal government supports a lot of research by scientists and engineers. But you point out in your book that people in the humanities, people in the social sciences, people who go through and get degrees in those fields also have a tremendous benefit to themselves personally, economically, as well as to the greater society. Tell us about some of those.
Yes, there are indirect effects as well as direct effects. And some of the private direct effects are benefits to each of the people who are listening. They're in the form of better health. Their children's health is better. The wife's or husband's health is better. The children tend to get more education, but also their cognitive skills are better. And happiness, we can come back to that, even increases. But it does.
Economists have measured how happy
people
are.
Well, yeah, well, psychologists have measured happiness, right. And we can come back to that. But it does, up to a point, connect to the earlier education. But the social benefits are distinct from these private benefits. They're the benefits to the state of Illinois and to the nation as a whole. And these that I've worked on relate to contributions to the development of democratic institutions. We can kind of see how important that is when we look at Libya. They don't have any hardly.
Sure.
That's true in Afghanistan. And so it's very hard for nations like that to get off the ground if they don't have education contributing to the development of civic institutions, but then also to human rights, which are really the civil liberties relating to the criminal justice system. And my wife was serving on a jury pool recently. That's an example. I mean, people give service to charitable organizations in the community and to all kinds of things like this that are part of the fabric of any society. That then contributes to political stability. And so there's another type of social benefit. A lower crime rate. People who have associate degrees or bachelors are not really very much in the criminal justice system. And lo and behold, that lowers the cost to the state of Illinois. They have lower expenditures on the prison system and on the criminal justice system as a result.
So you could actually measure that if people are high school graduates, have a two-year college degree or a four-year college degree, they are less and less likely to be in prison.
That's right. And so there's less and less state cost generated by these individuals. And they're instead contributing positively to the operation of the criminal justice system. And
paying taxes.
And paying taxes, right.
Yeah. We're talking with Professor Walter McMahon, whose new book, Higher Learning, Greater Good, The Private and Social Benefits of Higher Education, was published recently by Johns Hopkins University Press. We encourage listeners to Keeping the Faith to give us a call and join in this conversation. We're eager to have you ask a question or make a comment. In order to do that, punch in 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area in Illinois. If you're a listener in Indiana or farther around in Illinois, there's a toll-free number you may use, 1-800-222-9455. So if you're in the 217 area code and it's a local call, punch in 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-WILL. And that's true also if you're listening online at will.illinois.edu/AM. If you're hearing us online anywhere in the continental U.S., you can also use that 800 number, 222-9455. And, of course, if you miss part of this program, you can hear it at your convenience via your computer or smartphone or whatever by going to that website. And this program will be there in a week or so, and you can hear parts that you might miss because of your own personal schedule. And it'll be there for years to come, so do take advantage of that and other programs here on Keeping the Faith or Focus, other programs that are locally generated here at WILL. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. And it happens that Walt McMahon and I have known each other for a number of years. I'm not enthused about his book just because we're friends, but we have known each other. Walt has been a volunteer at the University YMCA, where I was director for 9 years. In fact, he was there much longer before I was and has served on that board of governors and helped guide that institution for many decades. Tell us a little bit about your own educational background, Walt. Where did you grow up?
Well, my home was in Clinton, Iowa, on the Mississippi, and I went to the University of Iowa as an undergraduate.
In Iowa City?
Yes. Uh-huh. Started my master's degree when something called the Korean War broke out, so I'd been in ROTC and got called in, first in Fort Riley, Kansas, and then in via Fort Lawton to Japan and Chemical, Radiological, and Biological Warfare School to Korea, where I was a second lieutenant and then a first lieutenant in the and came back then after being wounded and did finish my master's degree at the University of Iowa, and then I went to London School of Economics, prearranged to be there for a while. We had a child at the time, and so my wife and I were there together with our daughter and at LSE, and then I came back to the University of Iowa and finished my PhD there. I was involved as an undergraduate, as a president of the student YMCA, and then even worked a couple years as
in Iowa City.
Yeah, a part-time staff person there before coming down here.
What attracted you to that campus YMCA as a student?
Well, some really great people, not all of whom are alive right now, but Hal Colvin certainly was a very influential person in my life. Yeah, who you knew very well, I'm sure. But then also Ralph Sloman, who was there as the staff person, and Mo Fry, a very close friend who was a student there, and others in the student YMCA. A very, very active organization in those years.
And where did you go to first teach after getting your PhD in Iowa?
Well, I came here.
Directly to Illinois.
Directly to Illinois, that's right.
And that was 1952, you said?
57.
57, so, sorry. Yeah.
And I've been away quite a number of times. I went back to London School of Economics for an NSF postdoctoral fellowship. And then often during sabbatical years, but I was at INSEE, which is the research division of the Central Bureau of Statistics in Paris, at Erasmus University, at Econometrics Institute in Stockholm, and spent a year at University of Sussex in Britain. So I've been a number of different places in a way, but I've been here then, you know, basically straight through.
When you first started publishing in the fields of economics and education, one of your early books was published by the University of Illinois Press, and then a later one by Oxford University Press, and now this most recent one, Johns Hopkins.
And the new one that I'm working on is now done, and I've been over the proofs. It's called Education and Development, and it's coming out November 22nd of this year.
Who's publishing
Routledge,
that?
Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E, Limited in London. It's a large four-volume reference work, I should say. So it's not something I've written entirely, but introductories to each of the four volumes as well as to the series as a whole, as well as assembling the articles. So.
Now, as our listeners can probably figure out, if you came here to the University of Illinois to teach when you in 1957, you've had the emeritus status for some time. When did you actually retire officially from those kind of duties, regular teaching duties?
I think that was 1998.
98.
I had a graduate seminar in the economics of education and human capital, which I continued to teach for 3 years. Now Elizabeth Powers, who's in our department, has taken it over.
Uh-huh. So here you are still writing a major four-volume book, editing it, and how old might you be?
Well, you want it in years?
Yes. How many years?
I'm 83.
83. Mm-hmm. I have a reason for asking that, and I'll get back to that nosy question after we take a call on line number one, a caller from Champaign. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with Professor Waltz McMahon.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I wonder whether in your book you deal with a question that many books, recent books on higher education have brought up, namely the fact that the liberal arts seem to have shriveled away at American universities, and we now have presidential candidates who don't know where the Revolutionary War started, and aren't familiar with philosophy, history, literature, the arts, and so on and so forth. In fact, there's in a recent issue of Forbes magazine lists 50 best colleges in the United States. Not only one of them is in the Big Ten. And, of course, you can well imagine that it's a private university. But the public universities seem to be devoted exclusively to job training, not to education. I wonder what your views on that are.
I've been concerned about that, too. And, yes, the book does deal with this and fairly extensively and in somewhat different ways. My perspective on it is that there are major indirect effects from education. If a person is in some very vocationally oriented field, for example, there are then also indirect effects, not just the direct effects on earnings and growth as measured by economists, but also the indirect effects, which again economists do measure but have given too little attention to, and they don't tend to get included are recognized so well. For example, I mentioned earlier democratization and political stability. Well, a field like political science, you might think, contributes somewhat more significantly to public administration and to the roots of democracy. Constitutional law in the law school contributes to that. Fields like language contribute to international trade, and it's well known by economists in growth equations that trade is a contributor to economic growth. So there's an indirect effect coming from these social science disciplines and even fields like language, as I mentioned, that is getting overlooked. And sometimes the pure measure of contributions of education that look only at earnings and jobs tend to ignore that. Thank goodness provosts don't give full weight to, the purely monetary contributions of, and they do allocate funds to some of these other fields, but unfortunately these indirect effects are not well measured, not well understood, and therefore they tend to downplay them and underfund these areas. And so then there's the poor folks at the university and there's the rich folks, and those rich ones tend to be more north of Green Street and the poor folks tend to be more in Lincoln Hall. And unfortunately, but sadly and frankly, this does happen. But I think there again, it's because there's poor information. And so that's a major theme in the book, that there is this, you could call it misallocation due to poor, inadequate information. And in this case, it's because of the ignoring the indirect effects. There are also then the very large breadth of non-market effects that I've touched on but haven't really mentioned. We haven't really discussed in depth here. And these tend to get somewhat less weight than the purely monetary vocational effects, the fields that bring in the dollars.
Would you like to follow up, caller?
Oh, thank you very much. The only thing that I can think of is that you emphasize emphasize information. Of course, one of the problems is maintaining tradition in a way, and that's hard to do in the United States, whereas you take a place like Oxford or Cambridge, they have a tradition going back hundreds of years of knowing what a college is. We don't even know in the United States what a college is. We have universities, and we have College of Liberal Arts, which is just nothing but a bureaucratic collection of departments. It's not a college. And therefore, you know, some of these traditional links get lost in the United States. Well, that's my prejudice. I don't want to force it on you. So I'll end my comments with that, but I'm delighted to hear about your book. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. And again, other callers are encouraged to join the conversation, 333-9455 in the local listening area around Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. You mentioned in response to that caller, Walt, to the importance of getting information out to people about the values of higher education. And I'd noticed that in the last chapter, or maybe it's the next to last chapter of your book, you talk about three different types of information that you feel has gotten overlooked. And one type of that information is that these non-market benefits of higher education that might encourage people to put some personal money into sending their children to college, for example, need to be talked to. Parents need to learn that, but also legislators need to learn that. You also mentioned the kind of information, since states are cutting their support for higher education, state budgets are squeezed by public assistance, prison costs, Medicaid costs, lagging tax revenues, you say. Then you go on to say, but legislators and the public fail to realize that these pressures are largely due to the state underinvestment in education earlier in those people's lives.
Yes, that's right. I'm afraid that universities tend to testify before the state legislature talking only about costs, you know, defending the base, last year's base, plus what have been the inflation increments and utility cost increases that have occurred. And so what do legislators think universities do? Well, they generate costs, and rising costs. So then the reaction is to try to monitor and cut the costs. So the IBHE does, you know, spend quite a bit of time.
The Illinois Board of Higher Education.
Matter. Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And so the whole dialogue needs to be changed and focus more on outcomes. What are the benefits to the state? And as you mentioned, the underinvestment in education leads to a higher crime rate and leads to higher prison costs, and it leads to higher Medicaid costs. And so some of these costs are generated due to underinvestment in education earlier. I should stress, when we're talking about these non-market outcomes, that these are above and beyond the earnings and jobs effects. They're measured in such a way that the private benefits, the social benefits, are above and beyond earnings.
But there is a tremendous economic benefit to going to college, and I think you specify it's about, what, $38,000 a year or something. For people who have the benefit of going to a four-year college, yes, you have to subtract what they could have earned during those 4 years if they just stopped after high school, but it's still a tremendous benefit over their lifetime.
Yeah, it would be good to talk about that for just a moment, because there is a skill deficit, and there is an economic payoff from college, and the average person who's finished a two-year associate degree, for instance, earns $8,000 more per year than the average high school graduate.
Wow.
Over the lifetime, that comes to $360,000. The average bachelor's graduate earns, male, I've got the numbers here for a male in this case, earns $31,428 more.
Wow.
Per year than the average high school graduate.
Oh.
And over a lifetime, that's $1,413,000 more. And you can keep going. I mean, for a PhD, the average PhD earns $79,880 more per year than the average high school graduate. And over a year, that comes to $3,195,000.
Over a lifetime. Yeah.
Right. So there is a very substantial payoff. In rate of return terms, this associate degree is a payoff in real terms of 13.6%. This is both for males and females. That's a very, very good real rate of return.
Yeah,
in the stock market, mutual funds, it's been negative for the last
that's right.
You know, 8-10 years now.
What an investment.
Yeah.
We have a caller again. This is also on line number one, a caller from Urbana, Illinois. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with Professor Walter McMahon.
Hello. I'd like to ask a question. I tuned in late. You may have covered it, in which case you can skip it. But there's a recently published book called Academically Adrift, which has a different take on the outcomes of higher education, and it suggests that they are very meager insofar as students do not seem to acquire the reasoning skills and the writing skills that would be necessary and appropriate to function in a complicated economy. And I'd like to know if Professor McMahon has addressed those issues in his work.
Well, I'm certainly in favor of strengthening reasoning skills and capacity to analyze problems. This is a very, very important capacity, and it's part of the, in my view, quality of education. Education that can teach that. But I have to stick kind of, you know, on a point like this to what the data show, and the data show that the education, you know, whatever it is, however poor the quality is at the moment, pays off. And so that's where we are at the moment. And if you could improve the quality, improve the reasoning skills, that would probably would pay off even better. So I can only agree with you that that's desirable, but kind of casual empiricism won't really, you know, suffice. One has to kind of think through what actually the reality is and what the BLS data shows.
Okay, thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. And again, the numbers, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. We are about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program this afternoon. We're talking about some of the issues raised in the recent book, Higher Learning, Greater Good, The Private and Social Benefits of Higher Education by Walter W. McMahon. And this type of McMahon is spelled M-C, capital M-A-H-O-N. Published by Johns Hopkins University Press. My name is Steve Shoemaker, as I mentioned earlier, and I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, although next week I will be traveling. My wife and I are going to be having the fun of being with our grandchildren, so we'll be I will not be able to be here in person. Don Nolan, Professor Nolan, will be our guest host again, and he'll be talking next week with Reverend Elaine Olson of St. Andrew's Lutheran Church and St. Andrew's Lutheran Campus Center here at the University of Illinois about a series of three presentations that they are hosting on faith and science. And they have folks representing different religious traditions who are going to be speaking three different times. Let me give the dates for those. September 13 and October 11 and November 8. Part of the planning committee is Rob Chappell. He'll be joining Elaine Olson next Sunday here on Keeping the Faith, talking about those three programs. One of the speakers will be Professor Daniel Pack from Chemical and Biological Engineering, Biochemical Engineering. That's on October 11. On November 8, Alex Scheline, a professor of chemistry, will be talking on that topic, faith and science. And the September 13 program, I'm a little embarrassed to say that I've agreed to speak that night about that topic. I am looking forward to preparing that talk and invite listeners to come to any of those three. But you're getting a preview with next week here on Keeping the Faith. The following Sunday, September 11, we'll be rebroadcasting a 2009 program where we interviewed some folks who were relatives of victims of the attacks of 9/11. This will be the 10th anniversary that Sunday, September 11, of that eventful day. And these folks have formed a group has been very active since very soon after the tragedy, called Peaceful Tomorrows. And they've tried to influence U.S. government policy as well as people's attitudes to respond to that act of violence in peaceful ways. And they have some very interesting stories to tell, and I encourage you to listen from 5 to 6 p.m. Central Time, September 11, here on WILL AM 580. Heard also, of course, simultaneously at 90.9 FM and available online at will.illinois.edu/AM. Coming up in October, one of our guests will be the author Tess Hillmo, talking about her most recent book for young adults called With a Name Like Love. So that will be one of our October programs. That's October 2nd. Well, we have another caller waiting. Before I get to that caller, I promise to do it very soon, but let me just mention that support for Keeping the Faith for many years has been provided in part by the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And their program for Friday Forum talks at noon at the University Y start on September 16. And the first speaker will be Ruth Sweetser, former president of the American Association of University Women. And her topic will be, why are there so few women in science and technology and engineering and mathematics, and what to do about that? That'll be noon at the University Y, September 16, a free lecture. If you'd like to order food, you may call the Y at 337-1500. Well, let's get to a caller who's patiently waiting on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with Walt McMahon.
Thank you. Recently, there have been a number of writers commenting that they feel that perhaps too many students are going into college, that the unemployment rate among college graduates is rather high, that they acquire large indebtedness while in school, and that they might be better off, in the country better off, if they weren't to go to school, college. This seems wrong-headed to me, but would you please comment on this?
Well, I thank you very much for that question, because this is something that I thought was a big gap in everything we've discussed to this point. Graduate unemployment or overemployment, overeducation, you might say. I think it is quite wrong-headed. I mean, the data show that there's a very high return to those who have 2- and 4-year degrees, as I was saying, and a very low return to those who have high school and less. So that's what the market signals are telling us, what the data is saying. There's a shortage, not a surplus, of people with higher skills. Secondly, as technology surges forward and as more jobs are outsourced overseas, it tends to be the jobs that are less skilled that go overseas. Not all. There are some exceptions, but for the most part, that's the kind of job that, you know, manufacturing jobs, for example, we have lost and probably will never regain. Third, the trend in macroeconomic analysis, where I have worked for many years is very much toward looking at knowledge-based economies and how education is the source, large in numbers of people with more skills, all day, every day, talking about new ideas, exchanging ideas, creating new ideas. This is a driver of technical change, you might say. And then the skills on the in production as well are productive, and employers recognize that. So there's a skill deficit, not a skill surplus. The unemployment rate at the moment among those with less than high school education is 14.5%. And if you include those who have quit looking for work, it's closer to 28%. The unemployment rate among high school grads is 10%.
College or high school?
High school grads is 10%. The unemployment rate among college graduates is 4.2%. That's a drastic difference there. And the labor market, again, is saying we need more people with skills, not less. More people with less skills.
It seems to me that government needs to pay a larger share of the cost of the student's education. These high rates of indebtedness, particularly in certain fields, are a problem. But it seems that it pays back so much to society that we could well afford, probably from the national government, to underwrite these educations much more than we do now. When I went to undergraduate school, I didn't even pay tuition at the University of Wisconsin. And I didn't have to buy textbooks.
Who was paying?
Sort of underwriting is vastly eroded.
Who was paying that cost then?
The state.
The state of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Yes, well, this, you know, in principle, in economics, how should these costs be shared depends on what the nature of the benefits are. And if the benefits are to the broader society and future generations and to others, then, yes, that has to be borne publicly, because there isn't an incentive for private families, private students to, you know, invest and pay heavily for something that now somebody else, and including future generations, is going to benefit from. So there have not been large, you know, significant efforts to really seriously try to get at measuring how large the social benefits are relative to how large the private benefits are, earnings, jobs, that kind of thing. And so this is what I have been working on now for some years. And my best estimates are, if you include the indirect effects, which I mentioned earlier, as well as the direct effects, the social benefits come to close to 50% of the total benefits, not 100%. In other words, there's no just economic justification for 100% coverage of the costs. I've been working quite a bit in Scotland lately, and there the tuition is zero.
And in Greece, you mentioned in your book that there's no tuition by law, by constitution.
In the constitution, and you see the problem the French government is in. So the Greek government is in. So then when countries try to bear the full cost and charge zero tuition, you tend to get students flooding in, like in Pakistan, that's the case. Greece is the case. The quality is poor. The state doesn't have enough money to provide good quality education. The morale of the students is bad. The morale of the faculty, they're moonlighting, and it's not good. And there are not jobs for these graduates who are too large in number, and the quality of the education is so poor. And so many of the, in the case of Pakistan, for instance, the graduates emigrate, and they're running the underground system in Britain. And so that's one extreme where the state tries to cover the full amount. And the other extreme is tending to go toward total privatization. Then, as an earlier caller brought out, if you go to remove all state subsidy, have all privatization, then you tend to get a very highly vocationalized program.
That's where just the families or the students themselves are
right.
paying for it.
The focus will tend to be on which jobs, which fields, you know, are the jobs in, and how much do they pay? And the university allocates resources away from the humanities and the liberal arts and the fine arts and all toward MBA degrees and engineering STEM subjects, as well as business administration fields. And so then these indirect effects and the broader education side of it, you know, tends to get neglected. I think you see that at DeVry. You see that at
Phoenix.
Phoenix, yeah, where there's a private and also private for-profit, where there's not large endowment. I mean, where there's a large endowment, like you have at Harvard, let's say, for example, then that is a subsidy for, a substitute for public support. And they're then able to do public service and the broader humanities and social sciences are well supported. But what's happened is that in Illinois, as just as in other states, they've been cutting back in state support. The state of Illinois pays only 17% now of the budget of the University of Illinois. That's different than it used to be. And so maybe that's gone a little bit too far. And so best estimates are that I'm not applying this now strictly to the University of Illinois, but instead more broadly, about 50% of the benefits are social benefits, lower crime rates, better political stability, and so forth, lower state costs for Medicaid and Medicare, for Medicaid and for prison systems. So a 50-50 split seems to be about the best estimate, you know, as of the state of the art at the moment.
In terms of the benefits, yes.
Yeah.
We're talking with Professor Walter McMahon, Professor Emeritus of Education and Economics at the University of Illinois, about some of the material and ideas and concepts and recommendations in his new book, Higher Learning, Greater Good, The Private and Social Benefits of Higher Education, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Walter, I mentioned earlier I was nosy and asked your age, and partly I did that because of a recent article that's created quite a stir in the local newspaper, written by another emeritus professor from the University of Illinois in Chicago, who named David Rubenstein, and he said, "Thank you, Illinois taxpayers, for my cushy life." And he went on to talk about how he was able to manage to become a professor and didn't have to work very hard and tried to teach as little as possible, and now he's living off a very good pension. Why have you chosen a different way to be a professor? Why have you chosen to continue now into your 80s, still researching, still writing, still trying to contribute and to the education of young people and to try to help them see the value of education?
Well, I read that article, Steve, and I think it tells more about David Rubenstein than it does about what goes on in universities. It's not a very accurate view. That's not what I've seen in my department over the years. Sure, you can find an occasional individual that might be a David Rubenstein, but this is not typical. What has motivated me, I think you're asking, and I've been motivated very strongly by trying to improve the economic development in the poor countries. I've worked a lot in many other countries, Indonesia, Thailand, Nepal, Malawi, and others, such places, for USAID and the World Bank and for other international agencies, and have seen that the contribution of education to helping children get out of poverty and the country to develop more broadly, not just pure economic growth, but also more broadly in the ways we've been talking about, the contribution of education has been really very, very central. And to try to, I'm interested in the subject, and keep getting asked to do things in Scotland or wherever. They've just come out of the blue. And but it's basically because I've been concerned about economic development more broadly, not just in the United States, not just in Illinois, but worldwide and in the poor countries. And
you're
aware of this new book that's coming out really does develop, you know, endogenous growth theory, it's called, and in the endogeneity of new ideas, which we've been talking about a little bit here, but I haven't used the terms.
Thank you.
The central role of education in the whole process. It's not that education determines the outcomes or contributes everything, but it's a persistent force that is always there, and there's many effects that are indirect and in the long run kind of determines these outcomes more than we might expect.
And your concern and your interest in the developing world and the importance of education in those places showed up early in your earlier book published by Oxford University Press, Education and Development, Measuring the Social Benefits. And as you say, it's a continued interest of yours. Is that interest partly based on your own religious values and ethical standards? I happen to know you're a Unitarian Universalist in terms of your own religious activities and commitments. Have your values been shaped by that kind of training?
Well, yes, I think that's a fair statement. To try to make the world a better place has certainly been a strong motivating force. These are what skills I have, what limited skills I have, and so this is a way in which I feel that I can contribute. Putting it another way, I did give a sermon not long ago, believe it or not, you wouldn't believe this, but the meaning of life. And our philosophy club was, you know, discussing this subject, how universities should teach the meaning of life, and I got very dissatisfied that all these books are saying, hey, they should really do this, but nobody, no book addressed, you know, what is the meaning of life? And so I started thinking about that, and sure, there is a genetic component. Each of us have individual differences. But what is the meaning of life? And it does involve, what our education has really contributed. It's contributed to our health, to our children's health, to our children's education. This is true for every listener, and to our happiness to some extent. Again, we haven't discussed that, but then also social benefits, and some people are motivated to try to help others and to be attentive to trying to make the world a bit better. And so some of the social benefits of education, even though people may not be aware of it, their education is contributing to better civic institutions in the community, to the civil justice system, to political stability in the community, to lower crime rates, and so forth. So there is a, payoff from education that spreads out in this way, and that is part of the meaning of life, I think, right there.
There are some barriers to people doing well in education and also in the rest of their life that make it more difficult to enjoy some of the benefits of life, the good things of life. Someone who didn't want to be on the air but who did tell our tell me something here that I'm able to read off the computer. There's still problems with sexism. Males still get higher salaries than women in general. And also problems with ageism. People who are of advanced years sometimes get discriminated against, aren't listened to as carefully as if it were a young voice. There are people who've been trained in technical fields and who, despite getting good pay, don't like the work conditions, maybe problems with safety or stress issues. There's still a lot of problems with that we have to deal with as we try to think about how to make life better for more and more people. You deal with some of those issues in this book. You talk about the value, for example, of having an education in English, how that helps you in a lot of ways, in a lot of fields, but people may not be choosing to be English majors because they feel, oh, gee, I have to be an engineer to get a really good, decent salary these days. Other people who go into engineering get disappointed with it because of maybe job conditions.
Well, I think we come back again to the generation and adaptation and adoption of new ideas, and one's education does contribute to these ideas, and not just on the job. If you stop to think about it, the average person spends, let's say, 40 hours a week on the job, 72 hours a week, either at home or in the community. During those 72 hours, the human capital is being used all the time, and it can be used throughout the life cycle to kind of reinvent oneself to where one gets into a difficult situation. Think of ways over, under, around, or through, and not just be, frozen by it. And so that, I think, is to some extent a contribution of education right there, but also one's willingness to think in different ways and in different channels.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time on Keeping the Faith this week. Our guest has been Professor Walter W. McMahon, McMahon, author of Higher Learning, Greater Good, The Private and Social Benefits of Higher Education, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Professor McMahon is Professor Emeritus of Economics and Education here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He's also been a strong supporter for many decades and a member of the advisory governing board of the university, YMCA, that also supports Keeping the Faith. Next week on Keeping the Faith, I will be traveling, but Elaine Olson, Reverend Olson from St. Andrew's Lutheran Campus Center, St. Andrew's Church, will be a guest along with Rob Chappell, who have been planning a series of programs on faith and science that will be held there at St. Andrews on the University of Illinois campus on the corner of Wright and Chalmers. Coming up on September 13, October 11, and November 8. Faith and Science. And then September 11, again, we'll be replaying a program from 2009 about an organization called Peaceful Tomorrows, organized by family members of victims of 9/11 10 years earlier. And then on October 2nd, our guest will be Tess Hillmo, author of With a Name Like Love, a new book for young adults. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works, Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge and American Concierge magazines. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and a business and shopping guide. Concierge magazines are distributed throughout Central Illinois and always present the Champaign-Urbana and Bloomington-Normal areas at their best.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580